and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the worsening flooding in Houston as Hurricane Harvey, now a tropical storm, continues to dump up to 50 inches of rain over the surrounding area. Jeff Goodell, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and author of the forthcoming book, The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World, joins us to discuss the factors involved in contributing to this unnatural disaster. Along with the rising sea level due to global warming, we will examine the role of unchecked development in and around Houston as a result of the housing boom and the coastal subsidence, where the land has sunk more than a half a foot due to oil drilling. Another effect of global warming is the rising sea surface temperature, responsible for a 3% increase in average atmospheric moisture content for each half degree centigrade of warming, which has resulted in 3 to 5% more moisture in the atmosphere, creating the potential for more intense rainfalls known as rain bombs and much greater flooding. Then we'll assess Trump's remarks in a press conference today, in which he again called for the building of a border wall that he insists Mexico will pay for, while defending his controversial pardon of former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, who Trump claimed, quote, was treated unbelievably unfairly. Joining us to refute this absurdity is Antonia Nuri Fazan, a staff writer at the Phoenix New Times, where she has covered the former sheriff for years, and where she has an article, Latino Reaction to Arpaio Pardon, Just Throwing the Finger at Federal Judges. Then finally, we'll look into a repeat of the White House leaning on the CIA to cook the books on intelligence to justify a war against Iraq, with this time the target being Iran. Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi, the author of The Rise of the Pazduran and The Cultures of the Middle East, joins us to discuss White House pressure on the CIA to create evidence against Iran to support Trump's determination to tear up the nuclear agreement with Iran, which will end up as a gift to Iran's hardline rulers and undermine President Rouhani and the pro-democracy reformers. And joining us now is Jeff Goodell, who is a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and the author of five books, including How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate, which won the Grantham Prize, and Big Coal, the Dirty Secrets Behind America's Energy Future. And his forthcoming book out soon is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Goodell.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it hardly sounds civilized to destroy the planet, but that's what we are doing collectively, in the sense that, I mean, I blame Donald Trump more than myself, but I think collectively we are denying the obvious, are we not, in terms of the effects of global warming?
Yeah, we are. I mean, I think one of the things that's really important to kind of underscore about what's happening in Houston right now is that this is really a kind of man-made disaster. I mean, this is something that, this flooding has been accelerated and intensified by larger increases in rainfall, which has been long predicted by climate scientists as the world heats up, bigger storm surges as the seas rise, building in ways that doesn't acknowledge that this is going to be happening in our future. And, you know, this is really the kind of world we're heading into if we don't get more serious about really addressing this.
Well, in terms of the building and the sort of boomtown nature of Houston, ProPublica and the Texas Tribune published an in-depth investigation about how vulnerable Houston is in 2016. It was called Boomtown, Flood Town. And in that report, they said climate change will bring more frequent and fierce rainstorms to cities like Houston, but unchecked development remains a priority in the famously unzoned city, creating short-term economic gains for some while increasing flood risks for everyone. So that's one factor, surely.
It's a huge factor. I mean, you know, no one has been willing to acknowledge that, you know, we shouldn't be building in these low areas that are flood prone. We have a flood insurance policy that is a government flood insurance plan that is $25 billion in debt right now before the storm because of continued repeat building in areas that flood out all the time. for cities like Houston, as well as places like Miami and other cities that are low lying and risky, that are on the coast. You know, there's a tremendous incentive to allow developers to keep building in areas because they want to increase property taxes and populations of the city, and it's this kind of pro-growth argument. But, you know, we are putting more and more building in harm's way, and that's certainly true in Houston, and it's certainly true in other cities like Miami, Norfolk, Annapolis, all kinds of places that you can talk about. And whenever these places try to strengthen building standards, to require elevation that's higher, to require utilities and other critical infrastructure to be elevated, those arguments are shot down because they say that it will increase the cost of building and nobody wants to do that. So instead we have these sort of mega disasters like we're witnessing right now.
And another factor, and obviously I want to talk to you more about the global warming, but another factor is that the coast down there in the Gulf has subsided by about a half a foot, 15 centimeters over the past few decades because of oil drilling.
Right. And that's a big problem because as the coast subsides, of course, that just magnifies sea level rise. The oceans are rising. The coast is going down. So, you know, I mean, you have with especially in Houston, you know, you have this sort of obvious kind of terrible symbolism that this is the sort of, you know, the epicenter of the petrochemical industry that is being flooded out and devastated. You know, a lot of this is because of the carbon emissions that this industry has in fact released into the atmosphere and refuses and has fought tooth and nail against any kind of restrictions of those emissions.
Well, surely you can take that further. I mean, in the Trump administration, the very few achievements that have come so far for the Trump administration and the Congress has been almost the entire Koch brothers playbook. If you look at opening up the tar sands from Canada, opening up the pipelines, opening up offshore drilling, crippling the EPA, getting out of the Paris Accords, that is already Trump's legacy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, before Trump was elected, we all speculated, people who have been watching this for years, climate and energy issues like myself, that he might roll back some regulations. But it's shocking to even people who had kind of low expectations of what might be achieved under the Trump administration, just how much he's gutted everything that Obama achieved in his 8 years. Virtual wish list from big coal and big oil of what they've received. You know, the pulling out of Paris was one example. And you know, there's also subtler things that haven't gotten as much attention, like just a week before Hurricane Harvey hit, Trump rolled back Obama-era regulations requiring federal infrastructure to be raised for sea level rise and flooding concerns. So there was a very kind of comprehensive regulatory action to require bridges and highways and everything to take this kind of flooding into account. And a week before Harvey hit, before Hurricane Harvey hit, Trump rolled these things back. So I mean, it's at every level, not just the sort of energy and, you know, CO2 emissions level and EPA level, but in every place that he can do anything, he's done it.
But here he is on Twitter claiming he's doing great. Everything's great. Everybody's coordinating. The first responders are doing great. He's just putting out this public relations blitz that has no connection with the reality. So how does he get pulled over?
Well, I mean, he's contributed to this devastation and now likes to write in and kind of play the hero and the good guys. We're going to go rescue everybody, right? And instead of doing anything that might, you know, prevent this or forestall this or mitigate this or reduce these hazards, he's just letting it, you know, doing everything he can to kind of let it happen and then play the hero as he comes in and touts the rescuers, who are doing, of course, amazing jobs. But, you know, I mean, I think back to the year 2000 when I was out in the ocean with a climate scientist and we were going around on doing some sampling and doing some global warming science. And I said to him, you know, when is America going to kind of wake up to the risks of climate change and to understand what's really at stake here? And he said, oh, well, when a big hurricane wipes out a major American city, you know, that's when people will start to really understand what's at stake. And that was before Katrina. That was before Sandy. And, you know, we'll see what happens here with Harvey. You know, it's just the cultural disconnect and cognitive dissonance here is just mind-boggling.
Right, and the press is not even mentioning global warming, but they're talking about how it's going to affect the price of gasoline. And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Goodell, who's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and the author of five books, including How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering, and The Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate, which won the Grantham Prize, and Big Coal, The Dirty Secret Behind America's Energy Future. And his forthcoming book out soon is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. Let's talk about your book, Jeff, and the notion that maybe the mythological story of Atlantis wasn't such a myth after all.
Well, my book started after Hurricane Sandy, ironically. I was in New York City and, you know, saw the flooding and devastation that happened there. And in the aftermath, I was talking to some climate scientists and others. And, you know, I started to think about what would happen if the kind of water that came in during Sandy, or for that matter during Harvey, if this kind of came in and then stayed in and didn't retreat, because that's what sea level rise really is. These, what we're seeing now with Harvey, what we saw with Sandy, we're like, you know, sort of short-run experiments showing us what the world will look like when we have 8 or 9 feet more sea level rise. But I was talking to these scientists, and they said, well, you should think about, have you looked at Miami? And I said, no. And I went down and looked at Miami and arrived there at King Tide. And Miami, you have this, you know, great 21st century modern city that is, you know, doomed because of rising seas. You know, virtually, you know, 70 or 80% of the city is below 6 feet above sea level. You have incredible amounts of money and real estate built right on the water. It's all built on a kind of porous limestone, which makes it basically impossible to build seawalls or anything like that. And I just realized, wow, you know, this city, as we know it, is really doomed, you know, within my children's lifetime. And what does that mean? What are the consequences of that? And that's where my book kind of launched. And I spent then 2 years traveling around the world looking at other cities like Venice and Lagos in Africa and the Netherlands and how they're dealing with these issues of rising seas.
So when will Trump feel the water lapping at the front door of Mar-a-Lago?
Well, Mar-a-Lago is slightly higher than places in farther south, like in Miami, but it won't be long. You know, unfortunately, it probably won't be during this term of his presidency, and I kind of I'm hoping against hope that there isn't a second term. But you know, it's hard to say in the near term how fast this will happen. We know that, you know, the high end estimates by the end of the century are 6 to 9 feet. James Hansen, the godfather of global warming science at NASA, thinks it could be 10 feet or more. Something like that, you know, Mar-a-Lago is then an aquarium.
So given that how persuasive the science is, it's always been extraordinary that we are about the only country that where there's a denial industry. And of course, I think it's in part fed by this notion of balance, which our media is enslaved by, the idea that for every argument there's an equal and opposite argument, and that's allowed the phony denial of climate change, pseudoscience, to be equated with the science, just as creationism is equated with evolution. And I think to some extent Donald Trump was able to say that there was violence on both sides in Charlottesville because so many people believe that there are always these two sides to everything as a result of this convention that we have in our press. So what's your sense then of whether or not, I mean, the mitigation that you talk about in your book, you know, like geoengineering going on to sort of save the city of Venice, at the end of the day, that's not going to work, right? I mean,
No, it's not going to work. Yeah. You know, with things like sea level rise, mitigation is really important, you know, reducing CO2 emissions, because ultimately it lowers the temperature of the planet, the amount of warming we're going to see this century, and will slow the rise of the seas, but we're not going to stop it, certainly not in this century. So we have a certain amount of stuff sort of that's built in that we need to start thinking about and build and dealing with. That's why it's really important to kind of build differently and think differently about our cities. But I think what's really going to drive awareness of this stuff is not so much people like me talking about this, or, you know, even presidential leadership, I think that the economics are going to start changing very fast. I think that mortgage companies are going to stop giving 30-year mortgages in areas that are really flood-prone. I think the National Flood Insurance Program can't continue the way it is, and it's going to the cost of flood insurance is going to escalate very quickly. I think credit rating agencies are going to change credit ratings for cities that are in these flood-prone areas. And the economics are going to drive a lot of change, I think, pretty quickly on this.
So in other words, you've got the Koch brothers, the coal industry, and oil and gas, on the one hand, pushing denial and delay and obstruction. But then you've got the big insurance companies and others who have a dog in this fight. They're likely to be the allies of those of us who want to do something about global warming. Because if you do something now and you stop CO2 emissions now, the effects are still going to go on for decades, if not centuries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But, you know, you think about, and I've talked to many banks and mortgage companies, and, you know, to pick a simple example, you know, if you're building in an area of Houston, for example, or in Miami, where the flooding is getting worse and worse, it's very obvious. These storms are getting worse. It's happening more and more. You know, and you think about, am I going to give a 30-year mortgage to a house here? Because what is that mortgage or what is that house going to be worth in 30 years? Maybe nothing, maybe half of what it is. Once that calculation starts to really click in, which is going to happen, I think, very, very soon, the risk of this house in 30 years being worth half of what it's worth now, that's going to change the fundamental dynamics in a big way, because it's going to change the real estate values in places. It's going to change property tax rates. It's going to give cities less money to play with for rebuilding infrastructure, for schools, for cops, for all kinds of things. So I think the economic levers have been sort of hidden for a while, but are now going to start coming into play in a big way.
So back to Houston, Jeff Goodell, it could be as much as 50 inches in some places, which is extraordinary. Now, obviously, this storm has kind of stalled over the coastline and is dumping huge amounts of rain. But there is a new phenomenon that I heard about from Al Gore's new film on the sequel to The Inconvenient Truth, where he talks about rain bombs.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about that. Is that what's happening in Houston? You have rain bombs?
Well, I mean, I think that's a sort of metaphorical way of putting it. I mean, what climate scientists know very clearly is that the warming waters of the Gulf kind of rev up the intensity of storms and bring more precipitation. Michael Mann, a very esteemed climate scientist at Penn State, just the other day, talked about how he thinks the precipitation intensity or amount of rain in this storm is 30% greater because of the warming of the planet. So, and if this were, you know, the planet hadn't warmed the 1 degree or so that it has, there'd be 30% less rain. So we have this increased intensity because of the heat of the Gulf and the bigger sort of heat exchange that is driven by that and water exchange that is driven by that. And so these rain bombs are these sort of idea of these sort of much more dramatic and sudden precipitation events that are driven by this warming.
So what do you think is going to transpire then over the next couple of days? You know, I keep hoping for a teachable moment, but unfortunately all I've been taught by Donald Trump is wreckage and ruin, so I'm not naive to expect something good from him, but there's a hope that there'll be a pushback about what his pardon of Arpaio, that people will be educated about what a terrible person Arpaio really is. And I'm assuming that at some point or other people will be educated about the obvious, that you can't keep saying these anomalous weather events are anomalies.
Well, we can hope that. That's like the scientists that I was out in the Atlantic with, you know, before Katrina said, you know, maybe people will start to think differently after a major American city gets wiped out. But, you know, that's happened a number of times now, and it hasn't really changed the dynamic in a big way. I think that, you know, in the short term, we're going to see a lot of focus on, and justifiably, on the incredible heroics of people who are there rescuing people and getting people out of harm's way. I think we're going to see a lot of coverage of, you know, the devastation as the waters recede. And Then the big fight is going to be about who's going to pay for this and how the money is going to be spent and where the money is going to come from. Because, you know, as we continue to have these sort of, you know, climate change-driven disasters, the clear thing is that, you know, these are going to be paid for by everybody. They're not just being paid for by the people of Houston. I mean, they're the one who are suffering. But everyone in America is going to continue to pay this. And at a certain point, I think, you know, we spent $60 billion on, you know, after Hurricane Sandy in New York. I don't know what the numbers are for Harvey now. I don't think anybody knows, but there's certainly going to be something, I would guess, in that range. And at a certain point, people are going to get really tired of spending this amount of money on disaster relief and maybe start to say, well, maybe we should do something differently to try to prevent these disasters. Maybe we should build differently. Maybe we should cut CO2 emissions. Maybe we should listen to politicians who are really starting to talk about mitigating some of these risks and addressing real science and what is science telling us, right? We all knew the scientists were accurate when they predicted the eclipse, and it was right on, and it was a great moment for science. And that was a very profound thing to predict an eclipse like that. Well, they're telling us the same thing about the risks of climate change, and yet we're not listening.
Well, Jeff Goodell, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. Great to have you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Jeff Goodell, who's a contributing editor at Rolling Stone and the author of 5 books, including How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate, which won the Grantham Prize, and Big Coal, the Dirty Secrets Behind America's Energy Future. And his forthcoming book out soon is The Water Will Come, Rising Seas, Sinking Cities, and the Remaking of the Civilized World. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing Trump's remarks in a press conference today defending his controversial pardon of former Sheriff Joe Arpaio.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. This is gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to find yourself.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Antonia Nuri Farzan, who is a staff writer at the Phoenix New Times, where she has for years covered former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and where she has an article, Latino Reaction to Arpaio Pardon, Trump's Just Throwing Finger at the Federal Judges. Welcome to Background Briefing, Antonia Farzan.
Thanks for having me.
And President Trump held a press conference today with the leader of Finland at which he was asked a question about his controversial pardon of Sheriff Joe Arpaio. And the president said that he thought that Joe Arpaio was treated unbelievably unfairly and that Sheriff Joe is a great veteran of the military, a great law enforcement person. And then he went on to compare his pardon to the controversial clemency by Bill Clinton of Mark Rich and President Barack Obama's decision to commute the sentence of Chelsea Manning. But what's the local reaction? Is it still bubbling over in Maricopa County?
Absolutely. We already saw the ACLU of Arizona pushing back from this press conference and saying, if there's anyone who's treated unfairly, it's the people who are Arpaio wronged over the years, referring to the people who he racially profiled or wrongly arrested. Just because it happened on a Friday night in the middle of a hurricane heading for Texas at 5 p.m. Arizona time did not mean it went unnoticed. And today on Monday, people are still talking about it. And definitely the fact that Trump and Arpaio keep talking isn't making matters any better. So we're actually expecting there to be there's a protest scheduled for tomorrow at the federal courthouse, which is a group of lawyers who are actually coming out to protest what they see as an insult to the rule of law.
Well, at the press conference, President Trump was asked whether he tried to sort of hide the pardon by releasing the information in conjunction with the arrival of a hurricane over Texas that's impacted, obviously, Houston. And Trump had actually a pretty bizarre response to that. He said, I actually announced it at that time because I thought all the attention would be on the hurricane and this would help bring attention to the Arpaio pardon. So go figure.
Yeah, I don't even know what to make of that. But yeah, go figure, as he said.
So do you think, though, that my sense is that the rest of the country, and particularly Donald Trump's followers, the 35% that he keeps sort of throwing a bone to, that there's a great necessity to educate people about who Joe Arpaio is, and he's been incredibly mythologized. And my sense is that, of course, the guy that's led the campaign to mythologize and to make portray Joe Arpaio as a victim of the Obama Justice Department is this fellow Alex Jones, who's led the campaign to pardon Arpaio. What's your sense of whether there is a way to reach that 35% of people and let them know what you know and what most people, I believe, in Maricopa County know? And remember, back in November, Arpaio was soundly defeated in the elections by a double-digit margin. So my sense is that there's got to be a way to somehow let Trump's followers know that they're deifying the wrong guy.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. And I should start by saying a lot of what's floating around right now is this claim that it's a liberal judge who came after him and it was some kind of witch hunt. Well, the judge who charged him with contempt of court was actually an appointee of George W. Bush. So there just is no factual truth to the idea that Obama was somehow behind it. But to get to the question that you raised, definitely we did see him get voted out in November in part because he just got to be too expensive. A lot of conservative people who had backed him up until that point saw how much he was costing the county in lawsuits and frankly didn't want to pay for it anymore. So, you know, for the rest of the country who are not on the hook for those bills, they don't have that same impetus to say, you know, we should get rid of this guy. But it is interesting to see that some of the pushback was not necessarily from a human rights perspective or from a civil rights perspective, but simply just looking at what it costs. So I don't like it, but I guess sometimes that's the way to get through to people.
And what's the mood amongst the Latino population in Maricopa County and Arizona at large? Because that was at the heart of the injunction, was it not, that Arpaio mm-hmm. ignored, that he was racially profiling and sending his deputies out essentially to round up Latinos and stop them in Latino neighborhoods, literally pull them over and just like the Gestapo and say, show me your papers.
Absolutely, yeah. And what he finally got charged for was for contempt of court because after he was told he had to stop racially profiling, he didn't. He claimed in court that he had no idea of what was going on and wasn't involved with day-to-day operations. But he actually went on TV, I think at least 10 times, and talked about the fact that he was not following the judge's order. So that definitely didn't help his case much. But yeah, in terms of the reaction, I mean, definitely people are not happy about it. My colleagues and I were in the position Friday night really to be breaking the news to a lot of people. And one local immigrants' rights activist actually screamed when she heard the news. You know, everyone kind of knew it was coming back when Arpaio endorsed Trump earlier last year. It was very clear that he was angling for presidential pardon down the line. And even when the ruling came out that he was found guilty of contempt of court, a lot of people we talked to said, well, you know, I'm happy about it, but I don't really think he's ever going to do a day in prison, to be honest with you, because they figured that Trump would have his back. So there definitely is a sense this was expected, but I don't think that makes it feel like any less of a slap in the face to people who have been essentially terrorized by him over the years. It's basically saying law enforcement can do whatever they want and they don't have to follow the Constitution and there will be no consequences for that. So people are rightfully upset about it.
So how do you think this is going to impact? It looks as though Arizona is going to be the key state in terms of who holds the Senate in the 2018 elections. If the Democrats have a chance of winning the Senate. It would involve the two Senate seats there. And Donald Trump has effectively declared war on Jeff Flake, the junior senator, and campaigned, as he did a few days ago in Arizona, to replace him without naming him. And Trump's also attacked McCain. And McCain, of course, is recovering from brain surgery. So he may be vulnerable, both in terms of health and in terms of Trump's attacks on him. So what's your reading there, since you're there in Arizona and cover politics? What's your reading on where the Republican Party stands? Are they likely to go along with an extreme right-wing candidate who would primary Flake? And obviously McCain is not up for re-election, but he could be incapacitated.
Yeah, well, it's definitely interesting that you see both McCain and Flake coming out and condemning Trump's choice to pardon Arpaio. Flake certainly didn't do it in very strong terms and kind of just said he was opposed to the way the process had happened. But the fact that both of them are speaking out against that, I think, is really significant. I mean, Flake put out a book recently where he talks about how the future of the Republican Party is not being the party of angry old white men, and that they have to course the Latino vote, and they have to, you know, really be trying to not alienate immigrants, but instead to welcome them in if they want to survive. So certainly he's conscious of that, but at the same time, you do have a very strong anti-immigrant, pro-Trump faction in the state who, have been supportive of Trump and who have criticized McCain and Flake for standing up to Trump. So definitely very strong contingent that will be backing an alternative to Flake, and it'll just be interesting to see what the numbers are and if they end up pushing, you know, getting someone who's further right into office as opposed to getting someone further left in.
You mean somebody like Chemtrails Kelly?
Yep, Chemtrails Kelly is exactly what I was thinking of. Yeah, yeah.
And that, of course, is how Mitch McConnell's PAC described her, being a conspiracy theorist. And I think she's pretty much the one that Trump has signaled that he will put forward. Is that your understanding?
Right, yeah. And it's hard to tell. It's kind of been changing every day. For instance, at the Phoenix rally beforehand, he was talking all about Kelly Ward. And then when we got in there, all of a sudden, her supporters weren't allowed to wear Kelly Ward T-shirts. They weren't even allowed to have Kelly Ward stickers. So he was kind of suddenly distancing himself and apparently meeting with other candidates. So it's honestly just been very hard to keep track of who's in the running at this point. There's a lot of different names that have been floated out there. I mean, the Arizona treasurer, Jeff DeWitt, was Trump's campaign COO. But he said that he's not interested in running, but his name still gets thrown out there a lot. So, yeah, there's really just a lot of speculation at this point, but Kelly Ward is really the most well-known name who said that she's going to be throwing her hat in the ring, although how many people actually take her seriously in doing that is another question.
Well, Antonia Fazan, just to go back to the press conference today where Donald Trump praised Joe Arpaio and defended his decision to pardon him, he went on to say, as we say, Sheriff Joe, he's done a great job for the people of Arizona. He's very strong on borders, very strong on illegal immigration. He's loved in Arizona. Now, I mean, he obviously strong on borders, strong on, and by the way, Donald Trump went at great length talking about how he's going to build the wall and get Mexico to pay for it. But the claim that he's loved is certainly not supported by his defeat in the November election. So what's your reading on how much Arpaio is loved in Arizona?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there still is a strong contingent that supports him. I was actually out of town over the weekend, and as I was waiting for my flight back to Phoenix, I wasn't quite sure if I was on at the right gate because it didn't say Phoenix yet. And they heard a bunch of people talking about how much they loved Joe Arpaio and how it was the judge who should be in jail, not him, and how he was a hero to law enforcement all across the country and hadn't done anything wrong. So then I knew I was sitting in the right place. But yeah, that definitely is a faction that exists, but it's obviously not the majority, seeing as, like you said, he did get voted out. And I think what's also important to remember that a lot of people outside Arizona aren't aware of is that A lot of, you know, he was supposedly tough on crime, but a lot of investigations suffered because he was so focused on immigration and on cracking down on people who were supposedly here illegally. You had hundreds of sex crimes that did not get investigated, including at least 35 that involved child molestation, because they were spending so much time and resources in trying to track down undocumented immigrants. So for people who are seriously looking for a sheriff who takes crime prevention seriously, it was pretty clear that was not him. And I don't think that sending deputies out to Hawaii to look for Barack Obama's birth certificate helped either.
Well, Antonia Fazan, I find the whole thing extraordinary. And I go back to the need to for the American people to be educated about who the man is that Donald Trump pardoned and what his real record is like. And I hope at the end of the day that I take it you'll continue to do so. But outside of Arizona, I'm not sure that people are aware of the full picture.
Yeah, absolutely. We've been trying to get the word out by sharing some of our older coverage, because the Phoenix New Times has been covering him critically basically since he got into office. So we have 24 years of coverage that we've just been trying to spread the word to the rest of the country at this point.
Well, Antonia Nuri Fazan, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Antonia Nuri Fazan, who's a staff writer at the Phoenix New Times, where she has for years covered former Sheriff Joe Arpaio, and where she has an article, Latino Reaction to Arpaio Pardon, Trump's Just Throwing a Finger at Federal Judges. We're going to take a brief station break and back. We're going to do a repeat of the White House leaning on the CIA to cook the books on intelligence, this time to justify a war against Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi, whose books include The Rise of the Pashtun, which is about the social, political, and economic role of the guardians of the revolution in Iran, and The Cultures of the Middle East. And he contributes to the BBC and to Jain's Islamic Digest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rasul Nafisi.
Thank you for inviting me.
And what do you make of this kind of deja vu about cooking the intelligence in order to go to war, which is what happened with George Bush and Cheney and company, cooking the intelligence books, Cheney going over to the CIA, leaning on them to find incriminating information or even manufacture incriminating information about Saddam Hussein's activities? And now the same thing apparently is happening, that the Trump administration is leaning on the CIA to find incriminating information about Iran to suggest that they're not complying with the P5 plus one nuclear deal.
It is quite similar with one difference. At the time, Cheney and Bush were thinking actively of attacking Iraq. And they needed false information. This time, they want to basically abrogate the agreement between Iran and 5 plus 1. And the purpose is, according to the president during campaign and his presidency as well, to rewrite the agreement, which is an impossible task because basically Iran would not agree. And also Europeans have no interest of doing that.
Well, you could put this in the category of everything that Obama has done, Trump feels compelled to undo. That might be a serious motive, but it does seem like there's a fairly obvious intention here apparently there was a very contentious meeting with Tillerson and Secretary of State and with Bannon, who was still in the White House, over certifying the agreement recently, and which goes for 90 days.
Right.
And Trump himself in July said that if it were up to me, I would have had them, meaning the Iranians, non-compliant 180 days ago, he told the Wall Street Journal on the 25th of July. He also indicated at the time that he wasn't totally happy with Rex Tillerson, who had persuaded him to certify the agreement. So it's pretty clear where what Trump's intentions are, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. As I said, this has been one of the projects of or promises of President Trump to cancel the agreement, and it is based largely on a number of ideas. One of them is to, of course, make a contributors or the base happy, as well as the fact that it is, or the president may think, it is a very easy thing to do and look like a champion. Basically saying, you know, I have done this because the president has not been able to fulfill a lot of promises from the wall, you know, separating Mexico and U.S., all the way to beating up on China and all that. So he may think this is an easy task, but indeed I think it's a very hard task to do because Europeans are investing in billions of dollars in Iran, and they will be very unhappy to see sanctions again imposed on the relationship with the country.
And how will this affect Rouhani? Because the hardliners in Iran, obviously they didn't want Rouhani to be reelected, and they have criticized the deal. And if in any way the deal is broken, that's going to be play right into their hands, isn't it?
Yes, it is my long-time contention that in fact, the hardliners and conservatives and right-wingers of countries understand each other better than understand the moderates and progressives in their own country. And the same thing is here, meaning basically by attacking JCPOA, attacking Rouhani, in fact, and his achievement, which was a major cause of his re-election, the presidency here would help the hardliners in Iran, and in fact would be a terrible thing for progressives in the country, because they hope that by removing sanctions they will take away the alibi from the conservatives that U.S. is out there to get Iran, and basically that was their reason to have no relationship with the United States or the world that is desired by a lot of people in Iran. Actually, some time ago, it was 75% of Iranians wanted the reestablishment of relationship with the U.S., and I'm sure is much more now. So, yes, it is a terrible thing to do if you want to have some kind of, you know, democratic form in Iran to grow. And, of course, the opposite side, meaning the monopoly of power by the unelected officials enforced by, you know, military forces would be strengthened, because they say, see, we need to spend more money on defense. We need to spend more money on intervention in Syria and Iraq and Yemen and other places, because we are faced with a very powerful enemy that has nothing in mind but destroying us. The same process that led North Korea to spend so much money and energy to build all this nuclear technology.
And again, I'm speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi, whose books include The Rise of the Pashtun and The Cultures of the Middle East. He contributes to the BBC and to Jane's Islamic Digest. So Well, you mentioned earlier, Russell Nafisi, that in spite of the similarities with now the Trump administration leaning on the CIA to cook the books and to provide intelligence that would indicate that Iran is not complying with the nuclear deal, which Trump has been very critical of, and clearly Trump has a political guy at the head of the CIA in Mike Pompeo. He was one of the congressmen that led the charge on this bogus Benghazi story. And many people think he was put in there specifically as a political appointee to make sure that the Russian investigation went nowhere and that Trump would have the intelligence that he wanted, because he's been so critical of the intelligence community, which him and his coterie of right-wing zealots refer to as the deep state. So why are you confident that this will not result in a war? Because my sense is that you've got Betsy DeVos, the Secretary of Education, her brother, Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater, the mercenary army, has a mercenary army in the Gulf, in Dubai, and he's been largely financed of all people, the Chinese. But he's had all kinds of meetings with Bannon and with the White House to privatize the war in Afghanistan, but also to get involved with starting a war with Iran. And it wouldn't take a lot, for example, to close off the Straits of Hormuz. You've already got the IRGC running around in their speedboats. You know, Trump has already said that if they make any more insulting gestures towards our beautiful warships, we're not going to put up with it anymore. So I see this situation as being a lot more combustible, and that it could, in fact, lead to war.
The problem is an analogy between the Iraq situation. The problem is U.S. is in a much weaker position today than it used to be, especially financially. And moreover, they have a number of fires burning in the Middle East and Central Asia, and they don't really add up to it. At least people with a cooler head, Madsen or others, and they don't want to start another war because Iran seems to be the only stable country right now in that line. And, of course, even Turkey, the very close ally of the United States, now going through tremendous turmoil and getting closer to Russia and so on and so forth. So, to me, a wise counsel, a professional group of people actually that Trump has would tell him that messing with Iran is not a good idea. And right now, we don't want to have another Libya or Iraq on our hand. And more importantly, Iran has formidable defenses in the form of short-range and long-range missiles, and a lot of volunteers and a lot of PASDAR members or IRGC members who are around the American bases, and they can really cause a lot of trouble for U.S. bases in the region. And this will start a major, major war, which would not be limited to Iran. So, even Saudi Arabia probably wouldn't want right now, although they have said, let's kill the snake and all that. But if they look at it realistically, except they drop a couple of nuclear weapons on Iran, Iran would be a formidable country to war against. And lastly, I see that all of these beating drums and all that would cause Iran to move away from democracy. And that's my major worry all the time. That as long as Iran is on war footing, it will not have much of a chance for progressive forces to emerge. Although one may say, well, Iran has been really meddling in all countries, a troublesome country and all that, which I agree fully. But if you incite it to be more aggressive, if you cause more militarism in the country, it doesn't help at all with the cause of some kind of liberal formation or democratic growth in the country.
Well, it does seem that we've never understood the symmetry that you're talking about, how the hawks on both sides tend to feed each other, whether that was throughout the Cold War with Russia or the Soviet Union, and in this current situation with Iran. It's something that our hawks can't come to terms with, least of all the neoconservatives. But that's not to say that they're not beating the drum. And there are suggestions, for example, that the generals, as even though you take some comfort in the fact that they're sober and experienced people, they also hold a grudge against Iran, the Marine generals in particular, Mattis and Kelly, going back to the bombing of the Marine barracks back in 1983 under the Reagan administration. So, but on the other hand, I guess they understand that a war with Iran would not be a walkover like the Iraq war was, not that it didn't end up being a nightmare. Iran is a formidable enemy. But what about the pressure that comes constantly from both Israel and Saudi Arabia, who are in fact in some kind of de facto alliance? They seem to want the U.S., if not to go to war against Iran, but to maintain a hostile position. And some people have even suggested that Israel and Saudi Arabia would fight Iran to the last American.
Right. It is very interesting that you mentioned those two countries in the region, and especially if you look at the stockpiling of all weapons in Saudi Arabia, that in the last 20 years has reached to $1 trillion, and that's pretty huge for a country of that size. And it seems like, especially by the emergence of Mohammed bin Salman, who seems to like to make a big impact on the region, it is likely that regional wars will erupt. But again, a regional war will not help anybody, because it will, cause a problem for the flow of oil. It would cause for the American bases in the region. And lastly, because most leaders in the region are unpopular, including Iran, they would not want a major war that may cause trouble and their final removal. My understanding is if a major a skirmish occur in the Persian Gulf, chances are that the U.S. will destroy Iranian naval forces. And that is the most likely scenario that I can think of that humiliates Iran, and Iran cannot really retaliate because they know it's going to end up with a much larger war. So to my understanding, the balance of power is so critical in the region that getting into a war with Iran is a huge, huge endeavor. And a lot of people, even the generals you mentioned, and they hate Iran and they have suffered from Iran, know that how horrible wars are, especially by their experience in Iraq. So to me, sober minds will prevail. And the possibility of war is not that much, because we noticed that in the case of North Korea also, after all this harsh rhetoric and fiery statements by the president, nothing major was achieved and no war was started.
Well, we know that is the MO of this administration. Donald Trump is to distract people, and you mentioned that it's to keep his own base happy because he's not delivering on the big promises that he made, and he's not likely to deliver on the wall and all these other crazy things that he promised. So he has to keep throwing out these distractions. But nevertheless, he's capable of doing extraordinarily dangerous things, like pardoning this criminal sheriff who's trying to turn into a hero, which is a slap in the face to the entire U.S. judiciary system and the law enforcement community. And that's pretty huge. And I think he's shown that he has the propensity to do very crazy and dangerous things. So I wouldn't suggest that a sort of wag the dog war would be out of the question if he needs to boost his ratings in the polls. Except, of course, even a wag the dog war could get out of hand, right?
What I see is a Trump that is number one, a businessman, and he has mentioned in a variety of cases that we have spent so much money in the Middle East for nothing. And, for example, I think less than a month ago, he mentioned the number. He says we have spent $6 trillion in the region for no reason, which actually is a much exaggerated number. But he is concerned about money and he's concerned about profit. And he probably looks at Iran war as another costly endeavor. And he would not want to spend money on that again because there's no rate of return for this particular war effort. And number two, even if a very lawless person or a person who has no concern for laws, as you mentioned, would do stuff like pardoning a racist sheriff or this and that, these are all local and these are easy things to do and make a lot of rural right-wing racist people happy. But in a larger international arena, I think he would be very much left alone by a lot of people, especially the Congress. I don't think the Congress would get along and would provide the money or, basically the Congress here is starting more and more to move away from the president. Even about 40% seems to be ready to impeach him. It is not a very easy thing to do. Of course, I agree with you that a situation like a war, or major war, would cloud over all other things, and including a Russian investigation and so on and so forth. It is a major concern of me too. But if I look at the larger picture, I see the American elite would prefer to not go into this, would prefer to cause trouble for Iran, especially through maybe Saudi Arabia or other people. But direct intervention, I still find it very hard to believe, as I did about North Korea, when a lot of people were afraid that a nuclear war will erupt tomorrow.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your time, Rasul Nafisi.
Yes, Ian. Thank you very much for calling me.
And again, I've been speaking with Middle East expert Rasul Nafisi, whose books include The Rise of the Pasdaran, The Cultures of the Middle East, and he contributes to the BBC and to Jane's Islamic Digest. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.